You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
My sister, she said, "Dad, I think I know who kidnapped Elizabeth." And he said, "Well, who is it?" And she said, "I think it was Emmanuel." That was the name that he had used all during my kidnapping.
What was going through your head the first time you maybe had an opportunity to escape?
On the one hand, I was extremely hopeful. I did want to be rescued. I wanted to go home more than anything. But on the other side of things, as soon as that police officer walked in and flipped his badge open, Wanda Barzi, she immediately just clamped her hand down on my leg. And it was just like, it was like reliving everything all over again. It was like being kidnapped all over again. It was like being raped all over again for the first time. It was like being chained up all over again for the first time.
What was the core, do you think, of what got you through those 9 months? So, we're ready to go? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
So I have Elizabeth Smart on the podcast, and I was really nervous for this, actually, Elizabeth, because I didn't know for sure. I mean, you've been through so much trauma, and I'm sure everyone says that to you. And you there's a movie now on A&E, or a two-part documentary, not a documentary, because there's actresses and actors that play the roles, but it's Biography Presents Elizabeth Smart Autobiography. It's on A&E. You've been through so much trauma. It was 15 years ago. And I'm sure everyone says, "Oh, you've been through so much. You've been through so much." You must get sick of hearing that all the time. Actually, do you get sick of hearing that? You want to live a normal life.
I think when I first came home, it was pretty overwhelming to have everyone recognize me and coming up and talking to me. But as I kind of found that I had to create a new normal and kind of just had to accept that that's part of my life, I've come to the point where if that's my biggest problem in life, then that's a pretty small price to pay.
Well, we're going to dive into that comment. I'll start off describing the trauma and then maybe hand it off to you. But essentially, and you could correct me where I'm wrong on some of the facts, but essentially 15 years ago, you were a 14-year-old girl. You were lying in bed next to your sister, and there was suddenly a knife to your neck, and somebody who you were familiar with, who had been working in the around the house or whatever, says basically, "Come with me." It's the middle of the night. You were kidnapped. You were brought to the woods, to wherever this person was living. His wife was there, and basically forced you to change your clothes and become essentially part of their family. You become almost like I don't know how to describe it, but like this weird sort of kidnapped second wife. And he essentially treats you brutally, rapes you consistently for the 9 months after that. And then finally, people recognize him, and then through that recognize you. You were in veils whenever they went outside. Recognize you, you're saved, you go back to your quote-unquote normal world, but as you just said, it was a new normal. And, 15 years later, there's new things that come out in this in this A&E movie. It's excellent. But I really think the story of your renewal and your advocacy now on sexual abuse, and you know, we just had Stephen Tobolowsky in here to do a podcast, and he saw you and shook your hand and said you're like a personal hero of his for your endurance and how you've got through things. But what strikes me the most is during those 9 months, somehow you held on to this incredible faith that, I mean, you were going through horrific, horrific things, and you held on to this faith that I don't think a 14-year-old, nor like my 14-year-olds, wouldn't have had that faith. What was the core, do you think, of what got you through those 9 months? And did I get any of the facts wrong?
Well, you were pretty accurate with most of them. He wasn't really someone that I was familiar with. I'd seen him once out while I was school clothes shopping with my mom, and he came to my house once to do some yard work, and that was it. I had limited to no contact with him at all. So he was really a stranger. And then, yeah, everything else was pretty accurate.
I left out horrific details because there is horrifying details, but people could read that online. Trust us that it was horrific. More important to me is the endurance and how you got through it.
Yeah, so my family, they played a huge role in moving forward. I feel so lucky. Actually, it's crazy when I feel like it's crazy when I say this, but in the 15 years since I've been rescued, as I've gone out, I've spoken, as I've met other survivors and I've heard their stories, I feel so lucky that the person that kidnapped me and the person that abused me so much was a stranger, because most kidnappings, most abuse, most rape that takes place is by a family member or someone that you know.
And it could happen over years. It seems like everybody uses a story, particularly on a long-term abuse, like yours, it was a nine-month period. Everyone uses story to sort of justify lengthy abuse. In this case, there was religion was kind of this backdrop, not religion as anyone else follows it, but his crazy version of it. In many other cases, it's like family or, you know, some twisted relationship that the younger person is not old enough to understand. So, yes.
Right. And so I think had it been my family, I don't know that I would have survived. Had it been someone that I knew or that was a family friend or someone that I was related to, I don't know if I would have survived. And even if I had survived, I don't think I'd be doing what I do today. I think it would have been very difficult for me to move forward. I think it would have been very extremely difficult for me to speak about it, to do anything that has anything to do with the whole world of advocacy and sexual exploitation and prevention. So I feel very lucky that mine came from a stranger, because my family has been everything to me in my life. My parents, I don't know how many music lessons they sat in for me growing up and how many homework assignments they helped me through, or how many packed lunches my mom made because I didn't like the school lunch. I mean, my parents were there every step of the way for me growing up. And when I was kidnapped, all of those things, all those small things, having a lifetime of having them there for me, that really is what carried me through my kidnapping, was realizing that they would love me. They still would want me back. And religion, for me, I think it should be something beautiful. It should be something that brings you peace. It should be something that gives you hope when you feel like you're alone or you feel like you're wandering in darkness. And my parents, from a very early age on, they made it pretty simple. They said, you'll know a person by their actions. If they're a good person, they'll be doing good things. If they're a bad person, they'll be doing bad things. So despite the fact that my captors constantly were like, oh, God has commanded us to do this, God has commanded us to do that, this is all, you know, that we don't want to do this, but we have to because we're following God's command, it was always pretty easy for me to separate that from what they said from actual faith, from actual religion, because they were hurting me. They were hurting my family. They made me feel terrible. And that's bad. That's a bad thing. So for me, that was easy for me to say, well, they're not good people.
I think this is a really important thing to underline. It is that simple to recognize that just because they're saying God commands or religion commands or whatever, bad actions are bad actions and good actions are good actions. And particularly in this case, it's pretty clear what's bad and what's good. There's no subtlety here. And I think you've been unfairly, and I'm just saying it bluntly in the beginning of this, you've been unfairly accused of, let's call it Stockholm syndrome, where you kind of fall in line, what you were a young girl, you fall in line with what the captors are saying and get fooled by them. But I don't think in your story you ever for a second were fooled by what was happening. I think this backlash or this, or not backlash, but I think that statement on you is 100% wrong.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I knew the difference between what they were doing to me and what's acceptable behavior. I knew it, but I did, from the outside, I can understand why someone might say that. I can understand why someone might think that, but they just don't know.
Why do you think people think that?
I think it's easy to think that because my captors, eventually they did get to a point where they did feel like they could take me out into public. I mean, I was covered. I did have a veil on, but they felt like they could. They felt like they had enough control and enough power over me that they would be safe enough to take me out into public. And for a person not being in that situation, yeah, it might seem like it because, yes, I was out in public. Yes, there were times we were approached by police officers. It would be easy to think, well, she had every opportunity to run away, but that's not how it was. Yes, I was in the public, but I was 14. Not only that, I was quite a young 14-year-old. I was quite a naive 14-year-old. And everything that I had kind of felt safe and secure in had been taken away.
So to some extent, that must have hit your faith a little bit because did you ever think, oh, a lot of people think if I'm a good person, my faith will take care of me. But here you're in the worst situation possible. And like you say, you're a somewhat naive 14-year-old. It's probably very easy to think, what did I do wrong to allow this to happen to me?
Well, I think for me, I never thought it was my fault. I never felt guilt over what had happened because I was at home in my bed. I was asleep. I mean, I was doing everything that I was supposed to be doing. So that was not something that ever plagued me or ever bothered me. For me, when he kidnapped me, when he did all these things, I never felt like this was my doing or somehow I contributed to this situation. For me, it was, this is his decision. It's a bad decision. It's a wrong decision, but he decided to do this. This is all on him, well, and his wife.
And so one thing that moved me a lot in your story is that during these 9 months, when all of these things were happening, a lot of times you would find even the smallest things to be grateful for. So like, for instance, the campsite had a tent over your head. You know, like, was it hard to sort of remind yourself of these kind of almost self-help techniques to kind of keep on enduring? Like, how did you find things to be grateful for? Again, you're 14 and you're probably scared because you don't know what's going to happen next. I don't know how I would have survived.
I think I just got to a point where I was continually trying to, I don't know if outguess is the right word, but I was trying to prepare myself for what could possibly come next. Because initially, every time something happened, I thought, this is the worst. Nothing else can happen. Like, this is the bottom. This is the worst of the worst. But every time I thought that, he'd always come up with something new that would make it even worse. And so eventually I got to the point where I was like, okay, Let me just look at this situation for a second. And then in my mind, I would try to outguess him and say, okay, what could possibly make this situation worse? And then once I thought of something that would make the situation worse, that helped me be grateful for it not being worse. That made me, helped me to find the things to be grateful for.
Hmm. So it's kind of started almost from this stoic point of view, in that not necessarily optimism, but a severe pessimism. And then if things are not that, you kept expectations as low as possible, like beyond negative. And then, you know, people always say, happiness is, this is a weird for me, but happiness is reality over expectation. So if you keep the expectations as low as possible, it's a little easier to be happier even in this difficult situation. Not that you were happy, but that you survived.
Right. Yeah. That would be a fair way of explaining it.
And what was going on, do you think, ultimately in his head and in his wife's head, that they would do this, that they would even want to do this? And again, maybe this is a naive question. You've probably been asked this a billion times. I just want to know.
No, it's for him, I think that, well, I think you also have to take a step back and kind of look at that time period, what was going on in the world. I mean, 9/11 had happened. It wasn't like a distant memory. It had happened. It was fairly recent. Mm-hmm. And everyone's sort of, I think, emotions and vulnerabilities were extra sensitive at that time towards any form of extremism. And he realized that. And he realized that religion was that perfect vehicle to take advantage of any situation that he could. Because if anyone ever questioned him, he could say, well, that's against my religion, or this is part of my religion. And I think he had gone into that role so long, and he just found it was such a powerful, manipulative role that he could play extremely well, that he enjoyed doing it. And he enjoyed having control and power over other people. So I think it just grew. I think it started out small, and then it got to a point where he did feel he wanted a young girl. He wanted to rape young girls. And so he was able to twist and manipulate religion to the point where he felt like he could justify kidnapping to himself a young girl and rape her and claim her as his second wife. And he told Wanda Barzee, his actual wife, he told her all the things that she wanted to hear. She wanted to hear that she was special. She had a prior marriage where she had 6 children, and I've never met her first husband, so I honestly don't know. But the way she made him sound was that he was schizophrenic, that he abused her, all of these things. I don't know if that's true or not. For all I know, it could be a lie. But that's what she made it sound to me. And so then along came Brian Mitchell, and he told her all of the things he wanted to hear. And at first he seemed like straight and narrow kind of guy, like just as straight could be. Like, he had a job, he held a position within the Mormon church. He seemed to just be kind of an upstanding guy, but it was like little by little he kind of led her away, and she allowed herself because he told her everything she wanted to hear. She wanted to hear she was special. She wanted to hear she was beautiful. She wanted to hear that she had suffered so much in her life and that she had this great reward waiting for her in heaven. Do I think she knew what he was telling her was a load of crap? Yeah, I think she did underneath.
Do you think, I mean, you two had spent some time alone. Was there ever a moment where you felt like you could bond with her or get her?
She was never out to be my friend. Mm. She saw me as her, well, for lack of a better word, slave. Mm. She saw me as someone to do what she wanted her to do, someone that should remain loyal to her over her husband. And honestly, it's kind of hard to say which was worse of the two of them.
Even though she had been manipulated by him in some way, like he was sort of this massive controller over the situation.
But she helped enable that. Mm. And he was telling her things that she wanted to hear. And she supported him in his manipulation. She supported him in whatever he wanted to do. She encouraged him to rape me. She encouraged him.
In what way? Like, why would she want that?
Why would she want
that? Yeah, why would she encourage him?
I think probably for a number of reasons. I think on one hand, she allowed herself to fall into what he would tell her. she would hold on to that to try to believe it, try to convince herself that that was right. And if he was right, then that would mean that she was right. That would mean she was extra special. And so when she'd say to me that I needed to be grateful and that I needed to serve my husband and I needed to engage with him sexually and that was expected of me, that, I mean, that would make her look like she's let's pretend for one crazy minute that he was, if they were actually true, they're actually right, then that would appear that she's, you know, this magnanimous, supportive, incredible, suffered so much, then she would appear that way.
But it would, because so much of her life was invested in this guy's lifestyle, to put it that way, her brain probably had to convince her, oh, you must be doing the right thing.
But at the same time, from her prior marriage, she had 6 children. She had 6 children. You can't just, I don't care what happens to you. I don't care how terrible your life is. You cannot ever, after you've had 6 children, turn aside and say, yeah, that's okay. You go and rape that young girl.
Yeah, so clearly, it's hard to throw around the word mental illness because no one knows, but it almost sounds like a mental illness on her part to be so easily, to be convinced by this guy that this is an okay thing to happen. Like, she must have had something deep inside that when she's watching this and encouraging it, something must have felt like there's something wrong here. I don't know, though. I'm asking really more than wondering. Like, did you ever wonder, what is she thinking? He clearly was a monster. And I'm saying she's a monster, too. But was there ever any hope in you that she might not be?
Well, when he first told me, within the first few hours of me being kidnapped, and he said he was taking me to his wife, yes, I did have hope that there was a woman there, it was going to be okay, nothing that bad could truly happen. But I felt the utter betrayal from female to female was so complete from her, that almost makes me feel like maybe she was worse than he was. That's hard to say, but they're both pretty terrible.
Yeah, so during this time, did you ever, and like, again, you held on to faith, gratitude, your family, you always knew would accept you back, which, by the way, is probably a hard thing to feel because you probably felt so just traumatized by what was going on. I'm putting words in your mouth, but did you ever feel that any of these things had abandoned you? 9 months is a long time. Like, did you ever feel, oh, God's abandoned me, or my faith has, or my family's forgotten about me, or I'm damaged goods?
Oh, certainly. I certainly wondered if anyone could ever like me again, if anyone could ever be my friend again. I certainly had moments where I wondered if my parents would want me back, if they had known what had happened to me. I certainly had those moments, yes. But I think for me, I felt the few things that I had to hold on to, one was believing that God was there, that I wasn't completely alone with these two monsters, believing that there was a higher power watching over me. So that was something that I did hold on to very tightly to for those 9 months that I was kidnapped.
That's hard, though. Like, how do you hold on to that?
Yeah, well, what's the alternative? I mean,
the alternative, I think,
to think that you are completely alone, to think that there is no one watching you, that there is no hope to be had in the future. I think that would be harder.
I think that is the alternative, though, and I think many, and you know more than me, you've seen many people in abuse situations. You tell me, how many of them lose hope?
A lot of them. A lot of them do lose hope.
And what does losing hope look like?
Giving up. Giving up.
How do you then find them after they've given up?
I think for me, it's been trying to show them that they're not alone. one of the reasons why I've done the documentary, one of the reasons why I've done the TV movie, one of the reasons why I wrote my book, why I go out and I share my story is because it is so easy to feel like you're alone, to feel like nobody else could possibly understand what you're going through, to think that the world is going to look at you in a different way than they would have otherwise. I think it's very, very easy to feel that. And so for me, I want them to know that they're not alone. I want them to know that this happens actually a lot. And I think we've got daily proof of that in the news. Every time you turn on, I mean, it's someone else coming forward talking about abuse that's happened to them and why they didn't speak out sooner.
I think the why they didn't speak out sooner is always part of this narrative, and it ignores the fact of how, you know, okay, that might may or may not be an issue, but the real thing that happened was X. These questions that happen later is not X, which is the brutality, the abuse, the rapes in many cases, the harassment in other cases. It's almost like a way to distract from the question. And I think the most important thing about your story is not those 9 months, but the 15 years since, where you've not only rebuilt the life, but have been a strong proponent of this advocacy and helped so many people. But I think it is interesting to address the why, you know, what people have addressed with you is why didn't you escape? And we talked about it a little bit earlier. There's one question that stands out, which is like the first time police came up to you, I think you were in the library, you're wearing the veil, you know, there was no food or water. So now you're out and about trying to get. What was going through your head the first time you maybe had an opportunity to escape?
On the one hand, I was extremely hopeful. I did want to be rescued. I wanted to go home more than anything. But on the other side of things, as soon as that police officer walked in and flipped his badge open and, you know, flashed my two captors, Wanda Barzee, she immediately just clamped her hand down on my leg. And it was like reliving everything all over again. It was like being kidnapped all over again. It was like being raped all over again for the first time. It was like being chained up all over again for the first time. It was like all of those things that had happened. It was just like they happened all over again. And it was just, because that was September. So for the previous 3-4 months, I had been so abused and so threatened every single day that if I didn't do exactly what they wanted, then they'd kill me or they'd kill my family. It was like those words were just like going through my head over and over and over again. And I have a law-abiding family, but even still, when I'm driving on the freeway or something and I see a police car, I automatically look at how fast I'm going. I think anytime you see a policeman, you automatically kind of see, am I doing everything right? Is everything okay? Because they are an authority figure. And so there was also this other side of me that was like, well, what if I did say something and he didn't believe me because I'm just a kid? What if he believed my two captors? And what if I said something and he released me back to my captors? What if he didn't protect me? What if he didn't take me away? What if he didn't rescue me? So in my mind, it was not only was there this fear of everything that had happened and like a replaying of everything that had happened, but there was this other side of things that was like, I could be killed if I say something and he doesn't believe me and he leaves me alone with these two people. So it was almost a survival instinct just to freeze. And plus, that was basically what I'd been doing the previous 4 months, was just freezing, was not fighting back, was not screaming.
And you only have a few seconds to figure this out, right? Like, how long was the police officer right there in front of you?
He was just there a few minutes. He wasn't there long.
Did he ask you to take the veil down or?
Oh, he absolutely asked that. But Mitchell immediately spoke up. He said, this is part of our religion. You know, if we were to take her veil off, that would be, you know, violating her. And he's like, as her father, I can't allow you to do that. I'm so sorry. I just can't allow you. And he's like, well, could I convert? for, could I convert to your religion? He said, no, I'm sorry. It takes a lifetime of conversion. When is one person truly converted? You know, it's a lifetime of constant conversion. You know, the only men that will ever see her face are me, her father, and will be her husband one day. And then after we got out of the library, he laughed and he was like, oh, that was so good because I'm the only one that will ever see your face because I am your husband. And that was very low moment.
Did you have to play into it though? Did you have to like laugh at his joke?
I didn't laugh. I didn't say anything. When he would say things like that, it wasn't so much that he expected a reaction out of me. It was just like he was just trying to show me even more that he was all powerful, that he had control, complete control over the situation.
What do you think would have happened if you tried to break free right then and said to the police officer, yeah, this is me, these guys are bad, help? What do you, given that all these questions that you were asking yourself are legitimate, those things could have happened, there's a probability they could have happened, they could have just not believed you, and it sounds like this guy was a master manipulator, so who knows what could have happened. But what do you think in reality would have happened if you really think about it?
Well, from my perspective now, yeah, I think I could have been rescued at that point. I think I could have gone home at that point. But in my 14-year-old mind, I didn't know that. That didn't seem like a strong possibility.
Let's fast forward to when you did get rescued. What happened? What were your first feelings?
It was the same feelings all over, really. It was hope that I would be rescued. It was fear that if I said something that they wouldn't believe me, that I was endangering my life, I was endangering my family's life. Not to mention I'd had a further 5 months of horrific abuse on top. So at that point I was even more deteriorated than I was than my initial contact with the police.
What do you mean? What does that mean?
It just means that I had just been through so much more abuse.
But how are you deteriorated inside?
I just felt like, from day one that I was kidnapped, he was constantly wanting to strip me of everything that made me, of my name, of my family, of beliefs that I held, of standards that I had. He was constantly just trying to like knock those down one at a time. And so by the time that I was rescued, I had been severely, severely abused sexually. It was bad. It was terrible. And I had survived so much, and by that point I had survived because every decision I made was with survival in mind. And so going back to the prior question about Stockholm syndrome, from the outside looking in, the decisions that I made to survive to an outsider would look like I was going along with what they were saying. I was doing what they were wanting. But from an inside, from me, I was doing that because I was doing that to survive. I was doing that because I knew at the very least I would outlive them. There's a significant age difference between them and me. And so I remember thinking, well, even if I have to wait 30 years for them to die, I will outlive them and I want to survive. So I'm going to do whatever it takes, even if that means cleaning up mouse poop around the camp or doing my best to sew on patches onto the disgusting robes, or even if that means just lying there, allowing myself to be raped multiple times a day. If that's what it means to survive, then that's what I'm going to do. And so much had happened at that point that by the time the police officers came to rescue me, it was just It was, on the one hand, I very, very much wanted to be rescued. But on the other, I was doing what I had done for the previous 9 months and was surviving. It was that surviving survival mechanism kicking in.
And so what happened? So the police comes up. By then they had already known.
It was a lot of police officers. Yeah. I mean, I remember walking up State Street, and at first it was just one car and I thought maybe someone was getting pulled over, but then pretty soon the whole street was lined with police cars.
Because by that point, actually, as opposed to the last time, they had really identified this guy.
Yes. I'm not exactly sure at what point in the case he had become a person of interest, but my sister, she'd been looking at the Guinness Book of World Records, and my dad came in and she said, "Dad, I think I know who kidnapped Elizabeth." And he said, "Well, who is it?" And she said, "I think it was Emmanuel." That was the name that he'd given, he'd used all during my kidnapping, and that he told people was his name prior to my kidnapping. And so then that's when my dad went down to the police station with a couple of my brothers, and they did a composite sketch of him. And when that was finally released into the media, there were different family members of his that came forward and brought an actual picture of him, and he became a person of interest. So he was positively ID'd as that time where I was eventually rescued. And the officers came out, they started asking him all sorts of questions. And from the moment, because during my time with them, he had taken me to Southern California for the winter, I had been able to convince them to return to Utah. And he had said before we started back, because we ended up hitchhiking back, he had come up with this whole story of who we were. We were traveling ministers for Jesus Christ. My name was Augustine Marshall, and he was Peter Marshall, and Wanda Barzee was going to be Juliet Marshall. And I was from a previous marriage. My mother lived in Florida. I came from Miami, and when I turned 18, I chose to come and join him and join in his ministry. He had this whole backstory all worked out. Very, very elaborate. And so as the officers first started questioning him, that was the story that he gave. He'd always told me never to speak, never to say anything unless I absolutely had to. And if I said something he didn't want me to say, that I'd be sorry for it. He'd kill me, he'd kill my family. So that threat was always there. And then the officers continued to question him, and then they started to question me. And as he was standing right next to me, I was giving the story that he told me to give him. I mean, he was right there, right next to me. And it really wasn't until one of the officers separated me away from my two captors that and started questioning me. And one of them was like, "You know, there's a girl, she's been missing now for a very long time. Her family's never given up hope. They've never stopped loving her. They want her to come home more than anything. Don't you want to go home?" And it was really only in that moment that I was finally able to admit who I was.
And then what happened that second?
Well, as soon as I did that, they turned me around, handcuffed me, and put me in the back of the police car. And
why'd they have to handcuff you?
Well, to be fair to them, I think that they'd never handled a case like mine before. I don't think they ever had anyone come back from being kidnapped. I don't think they knew what to do. Plus, I'd been gone for 9 months.
What did you say? Did you say, "Yes, I'm that girl"? Like, what did you exactly say?
I did not say, "Yes, I was that girl." I said, "Thou sayest," because Brian Mitchell and Wanda Barzee were still there, and I didn't know how much they could hear. I didn't know how much they were saying. So if I was going to admit who I was, I wanted to do it in a manner that if they were to just hear the words coming from me, they wouldn't exactly know what I was admitting to. So it did take me a minute to respond. It did take me a minute to say those words, and then to eventually say that, "Yes, I am Elizabeth Smart." And then when I was handcuffed, I was like, "Oh my gosh, I survived 9 months of hell and now I'm going to prison. I can't believe it."
And so you're in the back of the police car. There's two officers in the front. They know who you are, or they pretty much know who you are.
Yeah, they know who I was at that point.
And did any of them say, hey, don't handcuff her or let's hug her?
No. So much happened that day. I could be missing a fact. Someone could have said something, but in my memory, I don't remember anyone saying anything. I just remember them handcuffing me, putting me in the back of the car, telling me I had to go with them. And if that was the case, if my memory remembers it accurately, then I mean, I hope things have changed since
then. Guess maybe they...
But I guess they wouldn't have known what I've been through for 9 months. They wouldn't know if I'd be violent or if right. I would, I don't know, go crazy in the car. So I think they just decided that was probably the best protocol to follow. Plus, I think I've heard or had heard that any civilian riding in the car with the police in the back had to be handcuffed. So I don't know. I mean, maybe that's, I don't know. I guess that's just what they felt was the right thing to do. And so they did it. But that obviously made me be like, oh, shoot, maybe I shouldn't have said anything. Like, what have I done?
Not over yet. Like, you're,
no, my fear really didn't end until it was a little while later when I was in the police station. I was just in this small room and I remember just not knowing what was going on. I remember thinking, well, if they thought I was innocent, wouldn't they have taken me home or wouldn't they have let me call my family or something? Wouldn't they tell me what's going on? And then as I'm kind of thinking those thoughts, the door just burst open and it was my dad who came running into the room. And it really wasn't until he was hugging me that I finally felt it was going to be okay. I didn't know what was going to happen still, but I felt like it was going to be okay, that I wasn't going to be hurt again the way that these two people had hurt me the last 9 months. It was going to be okay.
And then were you able to be released with your dad?
They took my dad and I up to the Salt Lake headquarters where my mom was waiting with my brothers and my sister. And so I was reunited with them. And then after that, I was taken to the hospital where they checked me out, tested me for everything, I think. And then after that, I was finally brought home.
So then you're brought home that first day and it's not like they throw a party for you or anything. Like, what happened then?
I remember walking into my house and just thinking it looked like heaven. It was so beautiful. Like, there was carpet on the floor and running water, and my harp was still in the same place that it had been when I was kidnapped. And I remember trying to play the last song that I had learned and couldn't even make it through the first page. And I remember feeling a little bit embarrassed that I couldn't finish the song, but my mom and dad were both just crying and they're like, it's great. It's great. It's beautiful. I remember taking a bath. I mean, I hadn't bathed in 9 months, so that was pretty high up on my list of priorities to do when I got home. I remember that evening just being with my family and just being so happy. I feeling like everything that had really been taken away from me had all of a sudden been given back, and just being so excited about it and so just feeling like I didn't want to miss a single second. I didn't want to miss out on anything. I didn't want to miss a day of school, which probably if you asked me that 6 months later, I would have been like, yeah, it's okay. I can miss a day of school. But feeling like that when I came home, I didn't want to miss a day of school. I didn't want to miss, I don't know, holding a boy's hand for the first time. I didn't want to miss going to college. I didn't want to miss having a life, having a future. I didn't want to miss out on any of the normal parts of life that I thought had been taken away from me.
Even that first night, it seems like you had this your first night back, you had this strength. Like, from what I understand, your family, very caring for you, wanted you to feel safe, wanted to all kind of sleep around each other so you would feel safe. But you were like, no, back to, I'm going to sleep in my bed, the same bed that you were kidnapped from. Like, were you wrestling with the post trauma here or?
No, I think my bed never hurt me. It wasn't my bed's fault that I was kidnapped. So I've never had like,
but what a trigger
negative
memories.
Feelings.
No.
Associated with my house or my bed or my room. I never had negative feelings towards that because they never did anything wrong. It was this man. He's the one that violated everything, violated my family's home, violated my bedroom. I mean, it was all him. So if you take him out of the picture, I'm still left with a wonderful home and family.
And were you confident that he was in jail and not getting out, like on parole, on bail or anything like that?
I mean, at that point in time, that wasn't even a thought in my head.
You were just happy to be
I was just out. Happy to be home, happy to be able to shower, happy to have food, happy to...
And it's such an unusual thing, obviously, for a family to have to deal with, but how did you then begin the discussions with your family about what happened during those 9 months?
It was, you know, it's really interesting because when I got home, I remember just feeling like I didn't want to talk about it, not because I couldn't, but because I didn't want to spend like the rest of my life talking about it. I didn't want to go and rehash it.
But here we are 15 years later.
I mean, here we are 15 years later. But I think that was very helpful. I couldn't have come home and done what I'm doing today. I couldn't have come home and just immediately come out with a book. I couldn't have come home and immediately come out with, you know, documentary and a TV movie. I couldn't have done that. I couldn't have come home and just immediately stepped into this role of advocate against sexual violence and child abuse and kidnapping. I couldn't have done that. I needed to come home. I needed to take time for me to recreate a sense of normalness in my life. I needed to experience that. And then I needed to go back to high school and I needed to go to college and I needed to experience all the things that came with that before I think I could have come to the stage. Because now, yes, now I do speak about it a lot. And I have done these various projects, but that's because I choose to. And that's because I feel like there is a greater purpose here for me. I don't feel like I have to do this. I feel like this is something I want to do because I have met so many other survivors who can't share their story, who are scared, who feel alone, who feel abandoned, who feel like nobody else could possibly understand where they've been. And having been where they've been, and then having experienced everything in between there and where I am today, you know, having had people question me, question my story, question my, I don't know, my mental stability, I know what that's like. And so I feel like if I can show it, if I can help people see what it really was like, then when they find out that their best friend was sexually abused or their sister or their friend or someone that they know is sexually abused, they won't ask them the same dumb questions that I've been asked for the last 15 years.
Yeah, so it's almost like your story of showing these questions and your answers provides an example of, it's like a guidebook to many of these people who have been abused and come out of it, that it's okay, you can live no life is normal, but you can live a real fulfilling and happy and successful life afterwards. You don't have to be, yes, this trauma happened, yes, you'll never forget it, but life can be successful afterwards. It doesn't have to be this blight on your life forever in some ways. And so for you, I mean, like, so you're married. I mean, what was it like? And I hate to ask these questions, but like when you finally were like in a loving relationship, someone you had met that you had loved, like how were you able to be intimate without these, this trauma sort of rushing back? Is that a personal question?
Everyone asks. It's okay.
I'm one of those people asking the same questions.
That's okay. I think everyone does wonder. Well, once again, if I came home to an arranged marriage where I was forced into it, if it was with someone who greatly outnumbered my few years, if it was expected like immediately right off the bat, no, I don't think I'd be able to. I think I would have a problem having a marriage with my husband. I think I would have problems. But when I came back, that wasn't immediately expected of me, nor did I have an arranged, forced marriage, because it might work for some people, I don't know. But that wasn't expected for me. And I was able to go back to being a 15-year-old girl. I was...
High school students, your friends, cool in general?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there were times when I'd walk down the hall at school where people would say, Elizabeth Smart, and I would turn my head to see who was calling, thinking, oh, maybe it's one of my friends. But then no one would be there. They just wanted to see if I had turned to see if it really was me. So, I mean, yes, there was some of that. But for the most part, people who were my friends before my kidnapping were still my friends afterwards. And people who were fake friends, they faded pretty quickly.
And so then, again, like when you did meet someone you loved and he knew your story, obviously, mm-hmm. what do you think were the components that allowed you to say, okay, I'm going to have a loving kind of normal relationship as possible that I could with this person?
Honestly, by the time I got to that point, I mean, it was almost 10 years between the time that I got rescued and the time that I got married and decided to take my relationship to that level. There was almost a decade in between. And during that time, I had kind of all of the normal growing up things, you know, holding hands for the first time, having my first kiss, going on a date, going on lots of dates, dating a lot. And so then when I found my husband, our relationship just progressed like any other healthy, normal relationship. And you know, when our wedding night came, it wasn't awkward. It was just the way I imagined many wedding nights go.
And now also, you're such an advocate against, you know, sexual abuse, sexual exploitation. I think your case was so high profile, it kind of almost gives society a chance to say, oh, that was one case and we don't have to think about the other ones. But how prevalent in our society is this problem? Like, how do you measure it and how prevalent is it?
Well, I mean, I can talk statistics. It's 1 in 4 women, 1 in 6 men sexually abused. That's a lot. But for me personally, those numbers really did not sink in until I started meeting them, until I started speaking and they started coming forward and saying, Elizabeth, I've never told anyone this before, but when I was your age, the same thing happened to me. Or my husband raped me, or my, you know, college roommate's boyfriend, or whatever. When people started coming forward and telling me these issues, I can say with 100% surety that every time I've spoken, I look out in the audience and I know that I'm not the only woman or the only person, because it's not just a woman's problem. Men are raped too. It's a lot harder, I think, for them to come forward because they're not supposed to have that happen to them. They're supposed to be the strong ones. They're supposed to be the stronger sex, supposedly. But I can look in a room and I know that I'm not the only one who has experienced those things. And I mean, I can say that with 100% surety because almost every event that I've ever spoken at, I've always had people come up to me and disclose their abuse to me afterwards. So,
I mean, it's
everywhere.
It's unbelievable what you've been doing. I mean, you sharing your story in all these different ways has really, I think reminding the nation that, or the world, that this happens is so important. How many years would you say you've been in kind of the advocate role?
I don't know. It kind of came on pretty gradually because when I got home, my dad started mentioning stuff to me about the Amber Alert and he told me what it was. And I was like, oh yeah, I was like, that's a good thing. That would be a really good thing. So I went with him to Washington because I wanted to, because I thought it was a good thing. And so we went and we started talking about the Amber Alert to different congressmen, and it just started off kind of small like that. And then I guess it's been really more in the last 7 years that I feel like I've really taken it on and embraced it.
Well, Elizabeth, you've done such a great job. You really are like a hero. This is such an important issue. I'm so glad you took the time to talk to me about it. And your biography, the movie about your story is on A&E right now. Biography presents Elizabeth Smart autobiography. It's a 2-part series. I definitely recommend everyone watching this. This is an issue that everybody has to be aware of. And I mean, I don't know. Obviously, a million people have said, I'm sorry for what has happened to you, but I hope also that a lot of good comes from you taking this path of sharing your story. So again, that makes you, you know, a hero.
Well,
so thanks for coming on this podcast.
Thank you so much.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network at jamesaltucher.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. It means so much to me because I really love getting to do these podcasts and to talk to all of these incredible people. I learned so much, and I hope you learned so much as well. If you like the show, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.